do we know better where we're going if we know where we came from? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. We touched on history and adaptation before, but this time we're going way back to when people first started figuring out how to adapt more than 100,000 years ago. Your calls welcome at 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call of 550-8422. Brian Fagan is our guest, author of Cro-Magnon, How the Ice Age Gave Birth to the First Modern Humans, on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
BP, unlocking Alaska's resource potential.
Brian Fagan is our guest, and he joins us by telephone from California. I assume this is your home, your office?
Yes, indeed. Santa Barbara, California, where it's a beautiful day with bright sunshine, temperature in the upper 60s.
Well, in Anchorage, Alaska, it is snowing. It's sort of a wet snow, but it's still snow, and it's April.
Yeah, just like last week.
So, yes, you were just here, and I guess you got to do a little bit of traveling in Alaska and also attend the Anthropological Association meeting and do a book signing.
Yes, this was, I think, my ninth trip to Alaska. I've been up a lot. I love coming up. I gave a public lecture at the university. I did a book signing and gave a keynote banquet address to the Anthropological Association. And then I got to go out to the Aleutic Museum in Kodiak Island and had a wonderful time. So it was a really intellectually and personally lovely trip. I loved it.
Did you get to meet Sven Håkansson?
Indeed, a very, very remarkable, very special person. I have an enormous admiration for him and for his work.
Yeah, we got to get him on here sometime. He's a big fan. He's probably listening right now, so maybe he'll
even
call.
He's a wonderful man. Yeah, I have an enormous respect for his work.
Well, our telephone number here is 1-800-478-8255. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email is talk@aprn.org. And our guest is Brian Fagan. He's written this fascinating book, Cro-Magnon, How the Ice Age Gave Birth to the First Modern Humans. And, you know, I guess I'm going to ask you to start with sort of a thumbnail and maybe guide you through it. We've been rewriting prehistory pretty intensively for the last 20 years or so. When I first became aware of we were getting a new view of our past was when they started realizing how old these remains were in these caves in the Middle East, in Kafsa and Skul, I think. And the speculation then was, well, this is we're seeing the transition here between Neanderthal and Cro-Magnon. And that turns out not to be the case. It turns out that once they did the genetic analysis, they got to the point where they realized there wasn't that much, if any, interbreeding between these two different peoples that moved into Europe in prehistory during the Ice Age. And so we've got this situation of actually two different kinds of humans coexisting in a very, very severe environment. And the ones that we come from, all the people on Earth, as far as we can tell, are these amazing people with the big brains that you tell us so much about in this book. They start in Africa, right?
Yes. This is a fascinating story. The book began when I visited the National Museum of Prehistory in a little village called Les Azés in southwestern France, and I saw the displays of these people, which were literally just rows of stone tools, and I said to myself, this is ridiculous. These were people. They did much more than make tools. So I delved into, and the book is about basically two big themes. One is the relationship between the incoming modern people, the Cro-Magnons, as they're known as, and the ancient archaic Neanderthals, who were the indigenous people of Europe. And then the second part of the book is the story of how the Cro-Magnons originated in Africa. Genetically, that's where they think they came from, ultimately, how they passed through the Near East and settled in Europe in about 45,000 years ago, a long time ago, very rapidly. And then their history after that period, which is really interesting and ends with the end of the Ice Age and how they changed to that. And then finally, I point out that the Cro-Magnons are the ancestors of many, many Europeans, including, I may say, myself. So it's a lovely story.
It is, and you've put so many pieces together, and so much of it is so recent and really really puts way different shades on questions of human adaptation and evolution than what we had thought before. And I think where I want to start is that part in Africa where there's basically an enormous volcanic eruption that probably kills just about everybody.
There's been this enormous revolution in our understanding of the Cro-Magnons and the Neanderthals in the past 25 to 30 years. It's very exciting. And also, of course, of changing ancient climate and also of genetics. And all this comes together to paint what is at the moment a somewhat controversial picture of these people. But it all really begins with two things. One is the fact that genetically, we're pretty sure now, thanks to mitochondrial DNA, which is inherited through the mother, that modern humans developed in southern Africa about 200,000 years ago or so. Small numbers of them. But one of the defining events which happened was much more recently, in about 73,000 years ago, when an entire mountain in Southeast Asia, Mount Toba, blew into space. This must have been a huge event, far more cataclysmic than, say, Mount Helens or the Krakatoa eruption of 1883, which blew an island up in Southeast Asia. And this caused a lake to form 1,200 foot deep and 60 miles long, a huge lake. It brought enormous quantities of ash into the atmosphere, much of which fell over Asia into China and the South China Sea and into India. And the result was that people living in India probably were swamped by ash, and many of them died. There was also, apparently, and this is controversial, maybe a six-year nuclear winter, or the effect of it, which caused temperatures to drop in Africa. And one theory suggests there was a genetic bottleneck, and only about 10,000 childbearing women in humanity survived. This may or may not be true, but certainly there was a major catastrophe. And from this, and from profound droughts in Africa, which we know about, it seems that modern humans spread out of Africa into the Near East perhaps 50 or 60,000 years ago. This is all highly tentative, but it is a fascinating scenario.
And we have then large brains, and we have people who are capable of speech. With the Neanderthals could vocalize, but it's doubtful they could articulate, right, as I understand it?
That is correct. Most people seem to think that. The Cro-Magnons were identical to us in their, what you would call, cognitive abilities, their ability to think, their ability to plan, their ability to imagine things, which is terribly important to hunting societies, and indeed to us. And they were our intellectual equals, no question.
Well, what you get reading this this history that you've written, and of course there's endless stuff about tool making in there, more than anybody that wasn't a specialist could possibly tolerate, but still, it's necessary because you're showing different ways of thinking and different ways of approaching the technology. But what you quickly realize is you've got people that, from a very, very early time, were, I guess I'm going to have to say superstitious. I don't quite know what word to use. I could use the word spiritual and feel just as good about it, I suppose. But they very definitely were, as you say, imagining, they were engaging with a world larger than the one in their immediate senses.
Oh, absolutely. There really isn't a word to define it. I mean, you can talk about cognitive abilities, you can talk about spiritual qualities, which, of course, opens up all sorts of other cans of worms.
Yeah.
But they did very definitely surround themselves with, or felt they were part of, a world in which supernatural forces and the spirits of animals and the spirits of their ancestors played a very, very important role. And one of the remarkable things is that in these societies, from very early times, apparently, there were people with unusual powers who were capable of recreating this supernatural world through song and chant and so on, and indeed mentally of transforming themselves into animals and into spiritual beings. And this is completely different to the Neanderthals, who did not have this ability.
And they were, we'll get back to that, because it's a very exciting area, but and actually persists into the modern era. I mean, it's pretty much still around.
I don't
have to really dig very deep for it, and that's one reason I want to go back to it. But to go back to this probably like 100,000 years ago or so, we had a stringent environment, isolated people who needed to communicate with one another to broaden their sense of terrain in order to just be able to find water through the year and exchange information about game presence and movement and probably trade. I mean, you really see trade come in fairly early.
Yes, you do. I mean, one of the critical things that people forget, because we live in a very crowded world, even in Alaska, although in Alaska you can imagine it being fewer people. Many of these people, certainly the Neanderthals and maybe even Cro-Magnons, probably met no more than a few dozen other human beings in the whole of their lives, and lived in extreme isolation. So any chance you had to exchange information with other people about what lay over the horizon, over water, over game and so on, was of critical importance, particularly in societies where all knowledge was transmitted not by writing, but by word of mouth. And this must have been very, very important to people living in this way, particularly in these savage environments, far colder than anything we can imagine on Earth today.
I'm picturing, Brian Fagan, you writing this book and keeping these big charts of what temperatures were and what weather conditions were, where at what times, and comparing them to the tools and to the human remains that have been found, and trying to make a pattern out of the whole thing, because that's what you've really done, is you've taken all these pieces and put them together into one very dramatic picture that goes a couple hundred thousand years.
This is the fun part of this, I mean, the challenge of it. People say that writing about archaeology for the general public is easy. It's not, because the challenge is, how do you take a row of stone tools, as you said, there's a lot in the book about tool making, and make it into a scientifically responsible, interesting, exciting story? And really, the Cro-Magnons, the fun of them is that they're really the first humans who were humans, to whom, in some senses, we can relate because we're the same. They lived in a different world to ours, but like us, they were fully human. And this is a major step, because then you can say, hey, people in the Arctic behave this way. I mean, there are only a certain number of ways you can kill a reindeer, for example, in the Arctic. And if you put this together, you can produce a story that is, of course, partly fictional, but in fact is the equivalent to writing a history of George Washington.
Well, I'm so glad that you brought up the subject of the Arctic, because I think that's where we want to go. First, it's almost all the Ice Age, although there's warm periods, quite warm periods, in this long stretch of time that you write of. So what that means is that the coast was actually in places, for the most part, that are out to sea now, that we can't really do very good archaeology in, and, you know, we don't really see much from. So that's one thing to keep in mind. The other thing is what you just said, that technology in the Arctic doesn't really change very fast. It really can't, because once you find the proven thing that works, that's the only thing that works. And so when you get to the period where basically Neanderthal is dying out and Cro-Magnon is adapting to an unimaginably severe climate lurch, you're really having to look to the Arctic, aren't you?
Oh, indeed. One of the great myths of the Ice Age is that it was a perennial deep freeze. It wasn't. The climate was changing all the time. And that does require a great ingenuity and capacity to innovate to make tools to deal with different conditions and so on. And basically, these people were extremely adaptive, as were Inuit and Eskimo in historic times, who were extremely clever with using, for example, different skins to make different items of clothing. For example, Eskimo and Inuit boots used in the Arctic, invariably the uppers were made of the hide from reindeer legs. Why? Because that's the toughest hide around. And the Aleuts used the leather from Stellar sea lions to make boots, and also, of course, to cover their baidakas or kayaks. So you've got extraordinarily detailed information on this, which much of which has a startling relevance to the Cro-Magnons, and with a little boldness, you can use it to project what people did and how it worked.
Yeah, and to some degree, you can also go back to the evidence then and confirm some of this. Because
indeed you can. Yes. Yeah.
So for instance, and let's say, for instance, the bow and arrow. I mean, you're not going to find too much in the way of sewn skins going back too far, right?
Sewn what?
Skins that are sewn. You're not.
You're only going to, and this is one of the reasons that our archaeologists are very preoccupied with stone, antler, and bone, is that organic materials don't survive. Skin, hide, hair, and so on. I mean, we'd all give our back teeth to find a Cro-Magnon site that preserved these things, which have to be waterlogged, and such a thing has never been found. So, yeah, we are really very limited in what we can do.
But there have been times then, however, that when you look to various Arctic technologies, indigenous technologies that are used even today, you can go back and find that among the people that were living in Europe, say 40,000 years ago, when it got really, really cold.
Oh, indeed, you can. And one of the most beautiful examples is the atlatl, or spear thrower, that hooked stick that you can use to extend the range of and velocity of a spear. These are found in Cro-Magnon sites going back at least 15,000 years, or the needle, which is a critically important Arctic artifact for making layered clothing, which enables you to survive in closely tailored clothes in sub-zero temperatures. The needle goes back at least 25,000 years and probably further than that. One of the most important artifacts ever invented, in fact. So there's a lot of different things going on.
I remember an article that Craig Medved wrote years ago. He was talking about polar explorers, and he says, fat's where it's at in the Arctic. And you know, it's really true.
Oh, indeed, it's true, yes.
This was an important part of the adaptation, was being able to, like, acquire fat, store fat, feed fat, and so forth, wasn't it?
Oh, indeed, yes. And also, the attitudes of the hunter were terribly important. You had to be very cautious, very able to improvise at a short notice, very capable of making decisions which literally could affect your survival at a moment's notice. I mean, these people were very, very adept at their environment, and they knew their environments far better than we know them. Much, much better.
You could probably say the same of Neanderthal. Yeah, they probably also had, there were skills and abilities. They had superior physical abilities, really. And they also needed to have a very intimate acquaintance. I mean, they were the people that were really more indigenous to the to Europe.
Oh, indeed. They must have been amazing people. And you get these stereotypes of the cartoons of the cave people with their clubs and long hair. And this is really insulting to Neanderthals, because these people were very strong, capable, adept hunters. And their knowledge of the environment was absolutely astounding, I would imagine. You read any of the novels by a guy called Bjorn Curtin?
No, I haven't.
Well, he wrote a series of books on novels about Neanderthal life, which are rather obscure. One was called Single Tusk. I think you can find them on Amazon. But these are brilliant reconstructions of what it must have been like to be a Neanderthal. Things like the shape of clouds, identifying plant foods. These guys, with the very limited technology they had, really were expert, very tough hunters. I mean, to kill a bison, and they killed big animals, they would have to stalk it and literally jump on the animal and spear it between the shoulder blades to wound it enough to immobilize it. These guys were tough. And I hate to meet one in a head-on fight.
Yeah, and they couldn't, it appears that they didn't really have so much a throwing type of spear either, that they were using more of a pike.
They were using, yeah, you would call it a thrusting spear, I think is the correct expression. They didn't have spear throwers, so the range was very limited. I suspect a lot of the time with big animals, they would try and stampede them into swamps and things like that, so that the animal was immobilized. We don't know. But yeah, a lot of it was brute strength, brilliant stalking ability. I mean, stalking for game, as you probably know, is incredibly hard. But these guys had to literally touch the animal before they could kill it.
Wow. So now...
It's very humbling in a way.
Yeah. I'm thinking, what do you figure then? I already know the answer, but I need you to really kind of describe it. I think, why did the Cro-Magnon, the Cro-Magnon... prevail in Europe? I mean, it appears that there was a long period of really coexistence between these two different types of people. They may not have communicated much or even been able to communicate, and we can only guess about how they regarded one another, but nonetheless, they coexisted. I mean, neither one was very densely populated, and there were certain places probably that, each were desirable for either one, but nonetheless, they coexisted. And then at some point, the Neanderthals just simply die out and the Cro-Magnons just essentially take over.
Yes, and this is one of the great mysteries of archaeology generally. And every time somebody finds something which throws a light on it, you get newspaper headlines. Oh, the Neanderthals were cannibals. Or, oh, the Neanderthals fought with the Cro-Magnons and killed them and whatever. Most of this stuff is really PR stories developed by university research offices or PR offices to try and attract funding. In fact, it's a complete mystery. But there are a number of things which can be said. The first one is, and I kind of say this in the book, I think the Neanderthals, who were small in numbers, I mean, there were never more than maybe 20 or 30,000 Neanderthals between the Atlantic and Central Asia. That estimate is a guess. So they were very thin on the ground. And I think they were, and I call them the quiet people, because I think they spent a lot of their time observing. And I think they were an elusive presence. And as the Cro-Magnons arrived with their clearly superior weaponry, they retreated to the margins. And although there may have occasionally been a fight or a confrontation, I think for the most part they coexisted. And to the Cro-Magnons, the Neanderthals were just part of the furniture. And as they slowly evaporated in numbers and breeding groups became less common, they were seen less and less, and I think eventually they just quietly died out. I don't think it was a dramatic death. I think they lasted till about 30,000 years ago in Spain, but they were doomed the moment these more effective, mentally much more agile humans came in.
And when some pretty severe climate lurches hit.
Yeah.
wouldn't you say? I mean, it got really cold there before it got warm.
And one of the things about climate change is that it was constant. And there is a great deal of argument as to whether the Neanderthals were written off by the extreme cold of the end of the Ice Age. In fact, they had survived extreme cold tens of thousand years before successfully. And they did it presumably by moving, but they did not have the layered clothing, the tailored clothing of modern humans. They didn't have the artifacts, and there is a school of thought which believes that they were killed off by increasing cold after 30,000 years ago. But once again, we can't prove it. I mean, when you get the academic literature arguing as to whether Neanderthals could survive successfully in snow cover, you begin to realize that people are kind of reaching out rather desperately for new explanations. The answer is we don't really know.
Do you think we're going to continue to get surprises in our knowledge base about this long period of prehistory? It seems that there have been a whole lot of them. Do you think that's going to continue?
Yes. Oh, yes. We're going to get a lot of surprises. I mean, just look at the last 25 years with all the advances in climate change research for a start, disregarding genetics and disregarding the increasingly fine-grained excavations that are now carried out and the information we can get from diets on the isotopic contents of bones and so on. It really is a much more fine-grained jigsaw puzzle that we're building. And I think some of the stuff that's going to turn up in the next 30 years is truly going to revolutionize what we know about both Neanderthals and Cro-Magnons.
Well, now, we basically had a very cold period that the Cro-Magnons were able to adapt to fairly successfully, even pretty far north, although probably not very large numbers. And then, you know, the last glacial maximum, I guess I'm talking about.
Yep.
And then it starts getting warmer. And if you leave out the Younger Dryas, which we probably should right now, we see their diets change, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The Cro-Magnons lived in a warming world after about 15,000 years ago, when temperatures regularly started to warm up. And their response to it, because there were small numbers and they lived in relatively small bands, and they could move. Some of them adapted to warmer conditions. Instead of hunting bison and reindeer, they started hunting deer and living more off plant animals and foods. Others simply followed their life way and moved northward in Europe, following the open steppe and the reindeer right up to the Baltic. And there's some fascinating research, which is again new, using radiocarbon dating, which shows tracks, literally the people moving north in small numbers and then larger numbers as it warmed up. And people living near Paris by about 15,000 years ago, they were living in Britain by 17,000. So, yes, there was a lot of adjustment.
Well, I want to go to the fascinating subject of cave art when we continue the program. But first, Brian, we're going to have to take a break. Our guest is Brian Fagan, author of Cro-Magnon, How the Ice Age Gave Birth to the First Modern Humans, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
the Alaska Children's Trust, sponsor of the Alaska Parent Line, providing parenting information, 1-800-643-5437. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
they could envision a world that was bigger than anything they could see, feel, or touch. They were the first artists, and they are us. Cro-Magnon is the subject today. Brian Fagan is our guest, author of Cro-Magnon, How the Ice Age Cave Gave Birth to the First Modern Humans. I keep saying cave, and that's because this whole subject is so linked in my mind to the cave art. We now have got dates on some of this cave art that is so old, it's hard to believe. I mean, I'm speaking of Chauvet. How old is that in France there?
The Grotte de Chauvet is one of the great archaeological discoveries of the last 30 or 40 years. It's a cave in southeastern France, away from the traditional area in southwest France, where they found absolutely magnificent paintings of rhinoceroses. These were the long-haired rhinoceroses, lionesses, horses, all kinds of animals, painted with a skill that is truly dramatic. I mean, in one place, they've got a herd of rhino, and they've got, the artist has drawn multiple horns, so you get an impression of lots of heads lined up. And when they started radiocarbon dating, they found that some of these paintings were 31,000 years old or even older, which caused quite a stir, because most people thought that the Cro-Magnon started painting art like this much later, maybe around 20 to 25,000 years ago. There are some problems with the dating, but really it seems that the Cro-Magnons as artists go back right to the very beginnings of the arrival of modern humans in Europe.
Have you managed to get into a bunch of these caves? When I went to Europe, which was a long time ago, 1964, they had closed off Lascaux because people were going in there and breathing, and it was damaging the art. And they did discover that you really need to be real careful with these things. Have you, as a professional, managed to get access to these environments?
I haven't tried in recent years. There are one or two caves you can still visit. Lascaux is closed, but the French have built an absolutely brilliant replica of it. It's wonderful and well worth seeing. Altamira in Spain, there is now, which of course is the classic cave with the bison. There's a beautiful replica just opened, which is lovely. I was very lucky and got into Lascaux many, many years ago, back in the late 50s when it was still open. I've also been to other caves.
See,
which
you were one of those. You were one of those guys breathing in there. That's why I couldn't get in there.
That's right. Yes, I'm as old as George Washington. No, I've been around a while. There is a cave which I'd strongly recommend to anybody who wants to see it. There's a cave called Pechmerle, P-E-C-H, one word, M-E-R-L-E, down in the Lou, which is quite close to Les Aisies. You can reach by car, where you can go in the cave and see the original paintings. And this is fabulous, because you go deep down in these chambers, and suddenly you look up and you'll see horses and handprints of the people who blew black and red ochre against the wall, presumably to acquire power from the supernatural animal spirits behind the cave walls. So the one or two, Chauvet is not open to the public. I've never seen it, alas, so much as I would like to. They take very, very limited numbers of people in, because these are priceless archives and we don't want to lose them. So you really are restricted to what's open. Fontagome is open. There are other ones. So if you go, look around, because you are some caves you can see, and to see them is something memorable. To see them with candlelight or with a flickering acetylene lamp is memorable too, although you won't see them because it's all electric now. But to see them that way, the animals kind of move in the shadows. It's really very dramatic, which, of course, is what the people who painted them intended.
Yeah, and it really, we can only speculate as to what was going on there, but it really seems there has to be some kind of ceremonial stuff going on. For one thing, these often were very hard to get to. And for another thing, you know, you have to consider the kind of illumination that they would have done with the technology they had at the time. And then there's just the matter of the actual execution of the art. It's just phenomenal. There's nothing else to say. If somebody goes through all this crawling and lighting and so forth and manages to pull off these amazing pieces of art. It's really mind blowing, and it's always going to be a mystery, I think. But I'm thinking that the effect must be so different to actually be in it, as opposed to just looking at the photographs, which is what I'm stuck with.
Oh yes, and I think one has to realize that these paintings had all sorts of different functions. If you go way, way in deep, there were signs and occasional animal paintings which clearly were painted by people who maybe have gone in there just alone. Maybe some of them were having what today are called vision quests, where they were on supernatural pilgrimages, acquiring power for themselves. Maybe some of them were what they call shamans, people with unusual supernatural powers. But in many caves, Neo in South France, for example, Altamira or Lascaux, it's clear that the paintings had ceremonial functions and involved forms of ceremonies, maybe the initiation of young people or whatever. In societies where knowledge is passed from one generation to the next by word of mouth, you use mnemonics, you use chants, you use dancing, you use song to communicate particularly supernatural knowledge. And they think that many of these caves, in fact, were used because the paintings usually are away from the light, from daylight. And as you point out, there were flickering lights. You're looking at ceremonies which were definitely performance. There was nothing these people who ran these things didn't know about running performances using light and smoke and smell and song. And some of them involve young people. For example, there's a very famous couple of clay bison, of all things, which lie in a chamber in a cave in southern France, way away from daylight. And around them are the footprints of people who clearly engaged in ceremonies around these bison, and among them are young children. So clearly this was an active form of ceremony away from the light. And in many caves, there are footprints.
Now, when we zoom back, one thing that you speculate is that there might have been artists who actually came fresh from the hunt to get something down on the cave wall. And another thing that brings to my mind the quality of observation that was going on. And this is something that anybody who hunts knows. It's almost all watching and waiting and guessing, you know. The actual killing part of the hunt is just a little tiny part of the actual experience. Most of it is trying to get things figured out and talking and waiting and thinking and whatnot. And these people must have been damn good at that.
They must have been incredible at it. And in fact, there is good evidence that some of the reindeer were painted at different seasons of the year. And this is extraordinary that we can observe that, because the hides of the animals look different. There was a remarkable gentleman, a paleontologist, who lives actually in Alaska, who used to teach at the university in Anchorage, Dale Guthrie, who is also an artist. And he's written a remarkable book about the art in which he explores some of these issues. And this book, for anyone seriously interested in it, is really, really worth having a look at. And it's very provocative, and it's full of brilliant ideas. He's a marvelous scholar, and he knows his animals, and I think he also hunts. But Dale's book is really a remarkable chronicle of what happened. I'm trying to look up the title of the book. I don't have it in front of me, but it really was a fabulous piece of work.
We'll get to it, and we'll start taking some calls if you're ready, Brian Fagan.
I'm ready when you are.
All right. We'll go to Stephen then, joins the program from Heidelberg. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Stephen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's good to be talking about such an important issue about ancestry. And I'd like to thank Brian Fagan for, I'm going to order his book. I'm looking at it online here. I'd like to, first of all, my Haida name is Ganya, and it's a very old name. And I'd like to speak about there are some sacred sites that were selected for protection through the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Particularly on Doll Island and Prince of Wales, there's caves that have petroglyphs and old bones of our ancestors in them. And some of them are, like Mr. Brian Fagan stated, that they're shamans that were living in these caves. And there are also some totem, some villages that are across from Heidelberg, Chipewyan Island, and Haukan, Klingquan, and Donatheda. And there's petroglyphs on the walls that tell the stories. And old totem poles, some of them are still standing, that tell the story of our ancestors. And it's very important that we discuss this, and probably through Mr. Fagan's book and University of Alaska, some of our sites have been dug up by people that come through Southeast. Some of our bones have been taken, and this is a very important. I wouldn't go down to Arlington Cemetery and start digging up bones, but I'd be in deep trouble. Or like in up in my wife's family up in Chickaloon, there's a burial mound there that dates back 700-800 years, 62.5 miles up in Penn Highway, one of the very oldest burial sites. And my wife's dad, Harry Nikolai, was a Second World War veteran that was stationed at Amchitka, and he got nuclear poisoning. And he said to make sure that the sites get protected. And I worked with Walter J. Hickel to do that. And we did get some protection there.
Stephen, I want to ask Brian to go to the subject that you brought up of respect for human remains, because I know that the paradigm has changed on that, and I think there's much more respect than there once was. I think scientists have always gotten real excited about these finds, and I think it's generally realized that it is necessary to have respect, and I think that's happening more and more, don't you, Brian?
This is one of the big issues of studying ancient Native American culture in the whole of the Americas, is this issue of one word, respect. And as the listener pointed out, what would people feel if we started digging up Arlington National Cemetery? Because in a way, this is what is going on. Fortunately, they have passed a legislation now which involves getting burials dug up many years ago from places like the Aleutians, repatriated and reburied. And this process is going on slowly all over the country. And I think it's safe to say that archaeologists today are far more aware of the need to pay respect. And in many parts of the world, including Alaska, archaeologists now are working much more closely with local communities to make sure that these things are done properly. But it is one of the old, terrible scandals of archaeology, is the lack of respect that used to be paid to Native American remains and others.
Yeah, and generally it is more becoming a matter of law in the United States, not just NAGPRA, but also in practice to consult with the locals and make sure that there's a proper reinterment or whatever is advised by the elders, Stephen. I think that the more of that is happening now, Stephen.
Yes, and I would add that one of the problems that isn't resolved is the very widespread looting of ancient villages, burial sites, and so on, which goes on even today. I mean, there have been these cases in Utah in the last year or two which show the pattern, and this is terrible and scandalous and ethically indefensible.
Yeah, and we're losing knowledge because of it. Stephen, I want to thank you for your call from Heidelberg.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.
And thank you, Stephen. Yeah.
It's Talk of Alaska. Our guest is Brian Fagan. We're talking about prehistory, and our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email is talk at APRN.com. www.alaskaresource.org. Now, we're talking about adaptation. And, Brian Fagan, we're in a time now where this word is starting to come back a whole lot. You know, we're seeing probably some irreversible changes in our climate. We all hope they're not totally irreversible, but, some of it ain't going to go away. And we're seeing our villages erode. We're seeing our elders fall through the ice on the rivers at times when nobody ever fell through the ice before. And the story goes on and on. When you start thinking about what is happening with predators, you think about what's happening with insects, when you think about potential impacts to public health, we're going to need to do some adapting. Maybe we need to look a lot closer at how adaptation took place in the past. What are your thoughts?
Oh, indeed we have. And one of the things I've done a lot of work on in recent years has been ancient climate change. This has been a major part of my career, I suppose is the word to use. And the one thing that's becoming very clear is that there's a great deal we can learn from the past, which is of use today and in the future. There has been this huge furor about global warming, are humans causing it, and so on. And this has become, unfortunately, a political football, which is regrettable. But the fact of the matter is, whether or not you believe humans have changed the climate, that we are living in a seriously warming world. And I did a study, for example, of the world 1,000 years ago, wrote a book about it called The Great Warming. And one of the things that really came up was the fact that there were widespread droughts 1,000 years ago, particularly in arid and semi-arid lands. And when I published this, together with projections of what's happening today, I was amazed at the reaction. A lot of people really picked up on this and suddenly realized that ancient climate really tells us a lot about the way it's going. And I think it's terribly important that we continue to study it.
Oh, boy, that brings us to your next book, I think, which is Water.
Yes.
The Triumph of Gravity. And I did want to touch on that. I understand you did a lecture on that, which I missed. But at least I got a chance to peruse the first chapter of this fascinating book. And, of course, water and gravity, they go together. But I've heard it speculated that water is going to be the commodity of the future. I mean, like beyond oil, the preciousness of water is going to be much more greatly realized in a very short period of time. In fact, even now is happening.
Oh, yes. This is one of the red-hot button issues of the next 10 to 20 years at least. For the reasons we just talked about, drought. And what I actually got involved with, and interestingly enough, I got involved as a direct result of giving a lecture to the California Water Policy Conference. These are the guys who really worry about whether there's enough water to go in the faucets. And they all said to me, write a book about ancient water because there must be lessons we can learn from the experience of the last 10,000 years. And when I sat down and started writing this, I was absolutely amazed. And basically, until the Industrial Revolution 150 years ago, we relied on gravity. It's only fossil fuels and deep water pumps which have allowed us to pump aquifers, which is basically what a lot of the city of Phoenix, a lot of L.A., a lot of Tucson, a lot of Las Vegas live on. And we really have a huge water crisis coming over the horizon in the next 50 years. And to have a historical perspective on it makes it even more sobering.
Wow. Brian Fagan is our guest. We're talking about adaptation and prehistory. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255 as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
the Association of Alaska School Boards. Their Helping Kids Succeed Fund provides support for youth leadership opportunities, digital learning, and education scholarships. Information at aasb.org.
Brian Fagan is our guest. He's the author of Cro-Magnon, How the Ice Age Gave Birth to the First Modern Humans. Brian, I'm looking for takeaways here as we go into the final home stretch of the program here, and I'm wondering if there are lessons we can get from what you have laid out in your book about maybe our belief systems and our capacities to adapt. It seems like when it comes to adaptation, we tend to not do it until it gets urgent, and I'm kind of afraid sometimes that our imaginations and our speculations and whatnot have sort of run away with us in our modern society. You know, that we have all sorts of superstitions that we might should have gotten rid of some time ago. But then again, at the same time, maybe it's the other way around, and we just need to become more aware of things that in our progress of all modernity, we have left behind and kind of forgotten about. What do you think?
This is absolutely fascinating, because you've got all sorts of things going on. In some ways, we are extremely conservative and old-fashioned. And it's quite clear that a critical part of being a human being are the kinds of spiritual and other beliefs that you carry with you. These are intensely personal things. They aren't necessarily things that are common, although, of course, there are organized religions. And the biggest lesson I learned from this book really was how terribly important these supernatural and spiritual dimensions are to our lives. And one of the things that has really come home to me with the Water book, actually, is just how we need to respect other ways of looking at the world, other ways of looking at the issue of conserving water. Water has always been a deeply spiritual part of life, and many societies have given sacred dimensions to water. For example, the Quran talks of the importance of water as a divine gift. So do the scriptures. And it's clear that we've really got to conserve water in the future and look at the spiritual dimensions of respecting it, which is something we haven't done much of. As far as the Cro-Magnons are concerned, it's clear that environmental relationships and relationships with animals were terribly important to them. They didn't think of game or food as a commodity. It was a living part of their lives. And I think as we move into the future with resources becoming more scarce, we're going to develop philosophies towards resources which may rival those in their complexity, be they part of organized religion or not.
You have a lovely fantasy in there, and I think it is it's when Cro-Magnons have moved to the north, and they're living off of reindeer, and there's a migration comes through. Everybody plans for it. They know where they're going to be. They do the hunt. And then after the hunt, a second migration comes through at night, and it's like their friends have come back. Nobody's going to go hunt anything now. It's just
I'm
their friends.
I'm glad you enjoyed that. I had fun writing that.
Yeah, I thought that was good, and especially living up here near the Caribou people and having been in their country, that carries a lot of meaning for me of the things that they were trying to tell me when I was up there. Some of my archaeology dilettantism has been in American Southwest, and I would assume when you wrote about water, you probably did write about some of that.
Yes.
I remember, for instance, someone had to tell me, but I went to a bunch of the different sites at Hovind Weep, which is kind of on the Utah-Colorado border, and somebody had to tell me, well, they'd see those piles of rocks over there, those were all structures, and we're not going to dig very many of them up because we're going to wait for better technology so that we can document them better. And then Chaco Canyon, which is like a, for anyone who has experienced it, has just got such a mystery to it and so much guessing going on about it, but it had to have something to do with water there.
Chaco is fascinating. I mean, it only had a carrying capacity of the land and water of about 2,200 people, and yet they built these huge pueblos.
Yeah.
And the question is why? And then, of course, the other question is why did they abandon them? And these, again, are great mysteries of the past.
Yeah, and not that long ago past.
Nope, about 1,000 years or less. Yeah.
Well, all right, when's your next book coming out?
I think it's March 2011. I'm waiting for the publisher to tell me. He has the manuscript at the moment, and he's pulling it apart, as they do, and I will find out from him the story.
How has reception been for Cro-Magnon?
Very favorable, surprisingly good, considering it's a relatively obscure subject. A lot of enthusiasm wherever I've talked about it, and it seems to be doing well.
Well, how about from the scientific community, though? I mean, because you
go out... early days. I will be nitpicked to death, as one always is, by academics, but that's part of the scholarly dialogue. A couple of colleagues who read the book loved it, so hopefully I won't come out too badly. I think it reflects pretty well state of knowledge. Where they will argue with me, of course, is where I've reconstructed a reindeer hunt or talked about trapping ptarmigan and so on. But that's legitimate. I'm writing a book for you, for the you general people who are interested in the subject. I'm not writing for academics.
Well, I guess what I appreciate about it most is that you really go for the story. I mean, a journalist, we learn to make a story. You know, you can have all the facts and figures in the world, but nobody will pay attention. You have to make a story out of it before anybody will even remember what they heard. And that's, you know, that's being human. Making a story, finding the story and making the story so that it's retained and passed on is kind of the essence of the kind of human beings that we are. You know what I mean?
Indeed, I do. And it's so incredibly hard with data like archaeology, which frankly is dull. I told a story in my lecture to the Alaska anthropologists of a thing I did on California where I had to describe 7,000 years of history where nothing happened. The only thing in the record are stones used for grinding wild vegetable foods. And after talking to some fellow writers, it became an idea that the sound would have been the thing that would stick in the memory, and I used that. So that's the sort of thing you do. It's very difficult and great fun.
Well, good. I'm glad it's great fun, and I'm glad you're still having it, and I'm glad you're taking this powerful ability you have to synthesize and putting it to the use of communicating, because I think we all have a lot to learn, and it's really basically educational.
Yes, indeed, and thank you for the kind words, and also thank you to everyone in Alaska who was so kind to me last week. I had a wonderful time and really learned a lot, and learning is what this whole business is about, learning about ourselves.
Well, hopefully we can get together sometime when the whales are coming in up in Barrow and have some muktuk together.
I would love that, yeah.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you for your time.
All right. Brian Fagan, author of Cro-Magnon, How the Ice Age Gave Birth to the First Modern Humans, was our guest today. Next week on Talk of Alaska, Alaska Spirit of Reading author Roland Smith, Kristen Spack on the phones, B.D. Trantina on the phones, Pat Yak, and Dave Waldron on the controls. I'm Steve Heimel. Thank you.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.